Hello and welcome back to another episode of Adventures in Movies, where we talk about the indie and genre films you've never heard of, the ones you can't hear enough about, and the ones you never want to hear about again. My name is Nathaniel Meir, and I'm the movie editor at AIPT. Joining me on these ongoing adventures is the host who's always rocking and a rolling on a Livingston Saturday night.
Oh, don't you know it? How surprised were you to see Jimmy Buffett? Anyway, we'll talk about that later. I'm Blake.
And it was better than Cheeseburgers in Paradise, I think, is a Livingston Saturday night. So this here episode is our 200th numbered episode of Adventures.
Yeah, right?
We're probably up at like 210, 215, but still. Yeah. 200, still, that's
200 official episodes.
So congratulations.
Put ourselves on the back a little bit.
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought of doing for the opening was mentioning how a few years back you mentioned that just kind of randomly you said, I will be on every episode next year. You did that and then some.
Pretty
crazy.
That just so happened to work out perfectly, right? I think I was a little cocky, but luckily we had a pandemic, shut everything down, and I was readily available.
Thank God for the coronavirus.
But I know, so we set some records on this peer podcast in time or two, I think. So
yeah, we've done the format has changed a lot. I mean, We've talked about everything from John Wick to Marvel to Red Book anthologies.
Oh my God.
quite a ride.
No, it's total blast.
It has been. And this episode, we're going to kind of revisit the past a little bit. We're going to kind of look at genre history later today, but we're also going to talk about genre of the future like we always do. But before we get into all that, we're going to revisit last week's episode, and this will be really quick. We talked about prestige films and how things have changed and all that good stuff with theater viewing. And one of the things that we said at the end was the Fablemans will kind of give us an idea of where things are headed. So Fablemans came out. It still hasn't done its full theater rollout. It hit theaters over Thanksgiving weekend. So that was supposed to be like, you know, kind of jumpstart it and everything.
Right.
And lo and behold, it did not do very well.
Like, are we talking colossal flop or like?
We're talking. So the thing that kind of instigated last week's conversation was that movie She Said, and it made a $2 million in the first weekend.
Sure.
Fablemans made $3 million over the Thanksgiving weekend.
Wow.
Yeah.
How the mighty have fallen.
Steven Spielberg, who actually is kind of responsible for one of the movies we're going to talk about.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's doing Bones and All. We talked about that. I mean, that's obviously very niche, small film. That actually did better than it, like on a per theater average.
Well, I mean, that sounds more fun than the dramatized theatrical life of Steven Spielberg.
Right, exactly. I mean, the only reason that I want to, and I have nothing against Steven Spielberg. He's directed some amazing movies.
Sure.
I mean, he's brought some great stuff to us. The main reason I want to see The Fablemans is because David Lynch has a cameo in it.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, and I'm like, wow, David Lynch in a Steven Spielberg movie about Steven Spielberg. many levels of weird. And I'm imagining he's probably playing like a director or actor or someone who influenced Steven Spielberg.
He's gotta be, right? No, I don't think he would take the role if it was anything different.
Yeah, I actually read a story about it, like a casting person. They actually had like an actor in mind for the part that David Lynch is playing.
Oh, okay.
And then the husband of the casting person was like, hey, you should get David Lynch.
They okay. Like,
and she was like, yeah, I guess he kind of would be cool. So they went to Steven Spielberg and he was like, oh no, he's not going to talk to me. So Steven Spielberg called Laura Dern, and Laura Dern contacted David Lynch, and then David Lynch was like, sure, I'll do it. So, Hollywood.
We just need, everybody needs that sweet Laura Dern contact. She can mend any bridge.
Any fences go to Laura Dern. We should send her over to the Ukraine and see what she can do. I guess I don't know if this was in the works already, but Fablemans has been did so poorly that Top Gun Maverick, which decimated the box office earlier this year, at least thanks to middle-aged Americans, I believe is what the story is.
That's so wild. That feels like that Top Gun came out a year ago. You know,
yeah, it was so long ago. I mean, yeah, I guess it wasn't, but I mean, it feels like it.
Right, it feels like a long time ago. I don't know. I'm actually, we were kind of laughing about it last week. This actually kind of makes me sad.
It is sad.
It is sad. You know, like these classic filmmaker guys. You know, I mean, if you're looking at the reviews and stuff, it's super well reviewed.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's got to be pretty decent.
I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, it's probably okay, but. Yeah, just like we were saying, I think we're just a different theater going community now. I think we'd much rather, again, we were talking about some other stuff. I was thinking about this later too. Scorsese, like, I think did some everybody some disservice too with like the
Irishman thing.
Yeah. Like I think this is all just people kind of, they're just kind of like, you know what? I'd rather watch that at home anyway. And I'm sure this movie's over 2 hours long, so I'm sure it'll do great on HBO or wherever it winds up, but
so
people don't want to watch it in theater.
You think it's the chickens coming home to roost?
Chickens are coming home to roost, buddy.
It's you know what's really funny is that or actually it's really sad because I think that at least I thought that James Cameron had overestimated how much people want to see Avatar, because I think the first one is horrible. Like I don't remember it. You know what?
I've never even seen it.
I don't actually remember it, but I remember hating it. And then I heard that this one is over 3 hours.
Over 3 hours.
Yeah. So then I was like, I think he overestimated how much people want to see it, but apparently it's I guess tickets have gone on sale. It's tracking really well. Like it's people are actually saying, well, Fablemans, yeah, but I can't wait for that Avatar sequel.
You know, it's funny, like we are more in the movie community than the average Joe. And I don't hear even amongst us talking about like movies that like, oh, that's coming out. Like every now and again, something will come out like The Green Knight. We'll be like, ooh, that's exciting. And we'll talk about it for a while. No, like normies that you just don't hear them talking about movies. I've heard so many people talking about this movie. It's outrageous. I guess people love that first one, man.
So you hear a lot of people talking about Avatar?
Yes, but not enough about genre of the future.
I gotta learn how you do that trick with your voice. it's December, so this is where normally all the Oscar baity movies would be coming out. So some of the genre stuff, it actually dies down in December a little bit, and then in January is when it starts to get crazy again for some reason. But there is some stuff coming out this week. The first movie, both of us have seen it, but I'll just get it out of the way. Coming to Netflix on December the 2nd. I think this flew under the radar a few months back, but Bullet Train is going to be coming.
Yeah, I think it did. I thought that was going to be like kind of a big hit, like blockbuster kind of thing. And I know I saw it, and I know you saw it, but I don't know anyone else who went and saw it.
I saw it, and I actually loved it. I thought it was really cool.
I was a big fan of that movie. That it's kind of a long flick, but it's super fun. Like there's not one moment. It's like one of those things, like if you got to get up in the theater to go to get anything or do something, you're bummed out because you know you're gonna miss something cool. It's a lot of fun movie, and so I'm glad that's gonna be readily available. I hope more people watch it.
I hope so too, because I thought it would do well too, because it has this, you know, it has Brad Pitt it has Zazie Beetz and Brian Tyree Henry and Joey King, Bad Bunny.
Bad Bunnies. Yeah,
it just has this large cast, and it's really quirky and funny. Non-stop action. And then it has this cool mystery with all these kind of threads that they're dropping you all these clues, and it all pays off in the end thing. Cool cameos are in it. Like
awesome. Just great styling. Like it's very stylistic and like seems kind of futuristic in a way, but not like far-flung future. You know, it's cool. I thought that movie did like just about everything right. Who directed it? Do you remember? It's somebody who's got that kind of pedigree.
Was it the guy who did what's it called? Atomic Blonde?
I think it is. Yes. Yeah.
It does have a similar like you said, style. It does have a similar look to that.
Yeah. David Leitch.
Yeah, David Leitch. Yeah. Yeah, and it also has the same kind of weird humor. Not weird humor. Has that same like humor. It's fast paced. It's fun. Like, and it tells a story. Like, but it's out of this world. Like you said, it's kind of futuristic, but it's not like I'm gonna go get my space food type of future now.
No, no. Yeah, there's almost a magical realism to it, right? Like it's like uncanny, like lots of uncanny shit happens. And it kind of a throwback to what I loved about old Guy Ritchie movies.
Yes, very much so. And along with the large cast and everything. So definitely, if you
Epic.
have Netflix, especially right now since the price has gone down and everything, like give
Oh
it a
yeah,
shot. It's
absolutely.
definitely worth your time. This year we've talked about, actually, you just mentioned it now. We like you never hear about people talking about movies. And I think one of the things is like you rarely see the commercials anymore. One movie I've seen a lot of commercials for is Violent Night. And
Yes.
that's coming December 2nd to theaters. And I don't know if I've ever seen David Harbour look like he's having so much fun. Like he's having a ball in this commercial.
What a great premise, man. The trailer, it's one of those trailers that probably trailers too much. But you get a real good idea of what's in store, and it's Santa, a little girl's wish for Santa is to have him save her from, looks like,
Mercenaries?
mercenaries trying to rob them.
Home invaders.
Yeah, home invaders. And going back to like we talked about, Lobo has a great issue where he battles Santa. It's famous actually. So I've always appreciated a violent clause, and this looks great. I could see this becoming a franchise.
Yeah, this looks really cool. Like you mentioned a violent Santa Claus. Like this looks better than that Santa Slay movie, but it's
Oh,
Slay.
yeah.
Yeah, that one kind of
That
didn't live up to expectations.
was like they
Like,
made the movie just because they had the
exactly. They're like, we got the title, Goldberg's gonna do it. Like,
title. Oh, yeah, Goldberg. That's right.
let's run with this one. I mean, this is John Leguizamo in it.
Pretty big
Always
cast.
awesome.
Honestly, like the production seems really high.
It
Like
does.
really high. So yeah, no, I think this looks super fun. I can't wait for this.
It's that time of year. It's Christmas movie, and who doesn't like Christmas horror? So
No, exactly.
this should be a lot of fun. Opposite end of the spectrum is now a very muted movie coming out called it's NR10, but it's Danish, I believe. So I'm gonna assume that's number 10. I don't know. It's
Yeah.
stylized to NR10, but
Number
it's
10.
it,
Number 10.
it's about a man who was apparently abandoned when he was a child, and then one day someone passes him on a bridge, whispers a word into his ears, and it kind of opens up all these secrets. Now, this is one of those movies where it's advertising like you're not gonna believe what happens at the end. So that's a very, very risky thing to do. But based on the trailer, I actually have the same feeling about that. It looks like it could either be a really, really cool thriller, or it might be a little bit on the dry side.
Yeah, I mean, at first glance, I was pretty excited and by this idea and premise. Watching the trailer, actually, I love this because this is kind of like this segment's kind of like trailer impressions and like and but really, this one, I think this trailer kind of gives full mystery, like zero kind of idea of what's happening. And if it, if it pays off, I think this has all the makings of something pretty neat.
Yeah, this one could be a lot of fun. This is like a lot of times you hear about the announcer saying stuff, but there's no context to it. So this trailer is basically a series of stuff that's kind of, there's very little context to what's going on. It looks like it could be really good, but I go back to Hunter Hunter because that's a movie that was also predicated on the ending. Well, they really pushed the ending, and at the time, I thought that that was an amazing movie, and I don't think that anybody will not like it, and I still think it is an amazing movie. But since then, I've seen lots of people say that, oh no, they just wanted to have a gross ending. So, I mean, I guess that can happen here, but I'm intrigued by what the trailer has provided.
Big time. Yeah, big time. Very any of these kind of like European-y dark hallway, I don't know. There's a vibe about these things. I'm looking forward.
Yeah, definitely. Another movie coming out on December 6th. December 2nd is a really big day. Coming to theaters. Remember the Magic 8 Balls that we used to play with them?
Yeah.
Did you ever think of combining a Magic 8 Ball with Hellraiser?
Now you've got a friendship game.
You absolutely, because someone apparently did. This stars Peyton List from Have you watched Cobra Kai on Netflix?
I have seen Cobra Kai. I would not have recognized her on the street.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I actually saw the name and then a comment mentioned, what is she worried about? She knows karate. And then I kind of I put the two together. But this movie looks like it's very cut and dry horror. It probably has a lot of jump scares in it, but I don't know. This is more so than the other one. It'll either be at best this will be kind of fun.
Oh, right. So yeah, the Magic 8-Ball. This movie is going to be you're going to know exactly what's going to happen by act two.
Yeah.
And not that's a bad thing. I think that's okay. But I think you've kind of nailed it. I think this looks like a lot of fun. My hopes are not going to be very high for this, but as you know, I'll watch this.
Yeah, it's a horror movie. And it's kind a
fucking
of,
horror movie.
Yeah, it looks like it's straight to the point.
It's an hour 20. Come on, dude. Like,
yeah, what do you expect?
Yeah.
Which leads to our last movie, De-Influencer, December 6th. Video on demand for this one. So lots of movies nowadays, and understandably so, about social media and all that good stuff. So this one is one of those where a person has been kidnapped. In this case, it's a cheerleader, and I'm guessing she's some sort of influencer.
Right.
And it looks like the person who's kidnapped her is making her do a series of internet challenges, not like the Milk Crate Challenge or Tide Pod. it looks like it's pretty much, it just looks like he wants her to get a bunch of likes in a time frame.
Yeah.
But also looks like the trailer pretty much shows you who the person behind the mask is.
I think the trailer did a horrible job.
But I don't know. There was really nothing else coming out.
But hey, look, the cover would have had me pick this up had I been walking the halls of Hastings, just because it's going to be a cheerleader running around.
It does have that quality to it. It absolutely does. And then in the trailer, there are scenes of her like progressively her selfies are getting sexier and less clothing. So it very much has an 80s vibe to
I'm into it.
Yeah, and I will say that I saw one on Shudder, and I don't remember the name of it. It was a very, very similar setup, except it had a murder mystery aspect to it. It was on a college campus, and someone had died at like a party, a frat party type thing or something like that. Oh, someone had captured four or five people who had been at the party and put them in these like kind of like confessional booths, except they were communicating them with like via chat or something, if I remember correctly. And it had to do with likes and dislikes and blah, blah, blah. But it ended up being as kind of convoluted and corny as all that sounds. The mystery aspect of it was actually pretty fun. It was kind of a cool movie. So I don't know, social media is so ubiquitous. I shouldn't try to say words I can't spell.
Ubiquitous, that's a hard
ubiquitous one. Yeah. Social media is such a constant in our lives that who knows, they might be able to do something good with this one, but it looks like it's pretty cut and dry.
Fun popcorn, forget about it the next day.
One of the movies we covered last week was Something in the Dirt from Aaron Moorhead and Justin Benson. For our 200th episode, we are lucky to have an interview with both of them. What was the inspiration behind Something in the Dirt?
I think what it was somewhere a few months into the early lockdowns of the pandemic. And we were kicking around exactly how we would, try to remain productive during that time. And we were reminded of all of these pitches that we'd done for the last decade, starting with our first film, Resolution, where, because Resolution technically lands in the horror genre, it's kind of a rite of passage that you just get sent every like haunted house franchise, and they kind of want to see your take on it, and not just haunted house, but this in particular. We always would pitch on it, and they would say like, give us your weirdest, most left of center, strangest, most out there idea. Like, we're looking for something fresh, and then we'd develop it over a week and pitch it. And, you could kind of see their eyes glaze over as we pitch it. They're like, oh, guys, not that left of center. We just wanted something. And so we never ended up getting those pitches and remained unemployed for a decade. But we had all these really cool left of center explorations of what we thought a haunted house could look like. And so in some ways it felt like a gauntlet had been thrown down that, you know, can we take on the haunted house genre while make it so that most people probably wouldn't even identify it as a haunted house movie, which is Something in the Dirt. And so we opened up that, that old dusty case file of haunted dead pitches and started putting them together into this idea of how we could make a movie in our kind of haunted seeming apartments during the pandemic.
All of that is 1,000% true. Here's another funny one. And we've said this before, but never quite in these terms. All of our movies, the intent is always that our main protagonist is not a traditional hero of the story. And obviously in Something in the Dirt, they're so flawed. They're clearly not one of these guys is a traditional hero in any way. But in every movie prior, we always get this note, or just would often get this note once or twice, would just be something like, well, I'm not really sure who the hero is. You might want to like, like clarify that a little bit, and just like commenting on like, oh, there's, you know, if that's your the sort of story structure thing you go to give people feedback, that's all they're saying. But it's funny because like our first movie Resolution, the intent was that Mike would be pretty flawed. And when you think about it, Mike Taze's best friend kidnapped him and handcuffed him to a pipe. He's super flawed. But I think Pete's so likable that it doesn't our intent to make him flawed doesn't always come across. Evan in Spring has a horrifying temper. In the first 5 minutes of the movie, he brutally attacks someone in a bar. Like there's, he's meant to be flawed. But again, Lou Taylor Pucci is so likable that maybe our intent to make him flawed doesn't always come across.
You're right. Anyway. I just realized this. Anthony Mackie is expected to be a hero. The word hero and Anthony Mackie are like hand in hand.
They're synonymous.
And so here we go. We go to great pains to show him being a total screw up and great pains to say that he makes these like gross decisions. And yet his people are still like, hero. He's got to be the hero.
Yeah. And it was just interesting. So anyways, so we were motivated to finally tell a story where, you know, within 5 or 10 minutes of meeting these guys, no one would ever mistake them as being the hero of the story.
And well, the characters are so important because usually in like a haunted house story or these types of more, you can get away with one-dimensional characters, but Levi and John are like the heart of the story. How much of yourselves are put into the characters?
I mean, Aaron's basically exactly John in real life. I'm very
no differences.
That's kind of scary.
No. If this ends up in print, it's worth saying he's joking. They're about as different as can be. There's a little tiny bit of observations about how we actually feel about the city of Los Angeles in there. But I think that John, the way that I was able to connect with that character as a performer was, I think John is someone I would have been had I taken a different path when I was about 12 years old. There was a different person I could have been that didn't end up turning into the person I am. And actually, I'll let you speak to Levi since you performed him, Justin. But basically, almost nothing is similar. Oh,
yeah,
but,
same
sorry,
thing.
Justin pointed this out. I'm sorry to interrupt. Justin pointed this out recently. It's interesting is because we used our childhood footage. These characters also have our childhoods, despite being not ourselves.
Yeah, and then like Aaron was saying, another big thing we intend to do from the get-go in this movie is just essentially we wanted these guys to be wildly different than who we are in real life. Some of those things came from things we characteristics we may have had in our childhood, but learned to veer away from them. There were characteristics in Levi that were things that characterized people I grew up with in my teenage years. And I guess in a weird way, wanted to honor what that was. A lot of like, there was a few guys who like really stuck out to me in my adolescence, but they unfortunately had passed away in the journey of their life. And I just want to kind of honor aspects of their personality. And also just things that I found fascinating. And they aren't always negative things. One thing that, you know, it's not always negative, but there's the thing that Levi says at the windowsill about feeling like he's always had this gravity on him, feeling like the universe was sort of conspiring against him. I remember just having friends growing up express that to me. And then, like, not always, but sometimes they'd been like 5 minutes later, they'd be like, you know, I was really trying to get clean, but then I was at the gas station and I'm pumping gas. And this guy just comes up to me and he's like, I really need you to take this, you know, this bag of drugs. And it's like, I don't think that the universe conspires that much. And it, you know, sometimes it's your own, it can feel that way, but really it's, you know, it's some of your own weaknesses. The weaknesses we all have as human beings.
There's some intense moments between the two, but even when everything's like humming smoothly between them, there's this underlying tension. There's like a give and take between them. Like, how important was it to get that feeling across to the audience?
Oh, such a great question. Because there was another thing that was rather complicated, but one of the most interesting challenges of making this film, which is we wanted people to wonder not just who the good guy is, who the bad guy is, and then land on, you know, they're both flawed, but hopefully land there, but also have very wildly changing loyalties and even wondering who the main character is. And by the way, that question mark should continue through the end of the film, that you finish the film and it's not, you don't land on, oh, I know who the main character was. So even starting the film on Levi and spending 3 minutes with him alone without saying a word indicates to the audience that this is going to be a movie about Levi. And so so finding that balance of exactly that push and pull, it was relatively easy, I think, as directors and performers, because we just knew the core of each character. You know, John was, in a sentence, a keep going person, and Levi was a I just want to live person. I just don't want to die, I guess, is a way to say it. And so it was kind of easy within the scenes to know where each of them would be at, because they both had the curiosity. They both had the desire to do this thing and figure it out. But they had different levels of self-preservation versus their desire to be great. So yeah, finding that balance, I think, was pretty easy as performers, just because the script had it so tight. It was so clear as we were setting into it.
You had mentioned Los Angeles earlier. Los Angeles is in a lot of movies, but you either get the whole I love LA version of it, or you get the exact opposite. You're going to look at Skid Row. This is right in the middle. People who are no names live in check to check. Really good for the genre setting. Like, why did you pick this particular setting?
Los Angeles had been more or less off limits to us. Our prior features were specifically written to take place in other cities. And, you know, like in the case of Resolution, The Endless, it's intentionally set in a place that we knew we had access to. And we want to run into expensive permitting or needing a whole lot of like highway patrol, needing to shut down roads or any of that. Essentially just things that were cost prohibitive or prohibitive for making an indie film. During the pandemic, it seemed like, I don't know, I'll give an example, like container laws changed. Like suddenly people go like walk down the street with a cocktail. So given that environment, it seemed like we could probably get away with shooting in Los Angeles with our tiny, tiny three-person crew still and be less likely to, you know, get arrested or fined or any of those things. And so it just felt like the city was open to us finally to make an independent film and to feature the places that, you know, even if it's not places that we personally go to a lot, it just seemed like a side to LA that is honest and had never really been expressed in cinema before. And then we're just visually interested.
I also remembered a little thing, because more just talking about, I think, about the characters than LA. But Justin, you and I saw Florida Project. And then also, I think this was after we made this movie, but saw Red Rocket. Really just, you know, Sean Baker has such an empathetic lens towards just the common person. And it made us realize that we just really wanted to tell a story that was someone that is right in the middle, you know, kind of there's this instinct in writing. Like it's probably in Robert McKee's story, is like, make your characters extremely exceptional in one way. They're an expert at one thing, you know, and that's what makes them interesting as a character. Or it's one of the things that makes them interesting. And I think we really wanted to make characters of people, like the most relatable thing in the world to us, which was just people that were right in the middle coasting on by when something happens to them. And that's the moment that they have to seize their destiny. And by the way, we're not in any way comparing ourselves to Sean Baker, who is a master. It was just the idea of people that are just right on the edge and could otherwise just be forgotten to history, if not for the events of the movie.
No, that makes complete sense. And my final question was, we live in a day and age where you have to pick sides for everything. So we mentioned this is a haunted house movie. There's comedy aspects, thriller, kind of a documentary feel at times. Like, how would you categorize Something in the Dirt if you had to?
This is going to sound really self-aggrandizing. And I don't mean it to be that way. But what we've been hoping to do for the last decade or so is to make films where people would just say, it's our production company, Rustic's Film. It's like a Rustic film. Or it's a Moorhead and Benson film, as opposed to needing to fall within a genre. And I think we've never made a film with the aim of landing squarely in any genre, but nor have we been trying to not. We just kind of follow our impulses of whatever we think is scary or unsettling or would hopefully give the audience a feeling of dread or is funny in the moment without violating tone. And that ultimately, on a long enough timeline, if we did this like 1,000 times, that when people see, again, our company logo, Rustic Film, so they see Moorhead and Benson, they know what they're getting themselves into.
This week we're doing things a little bit different. We're still going to cover two movies, but what we wanted to do is kind of cover two movies that we thought kind of reflected what our show was about. So for the past year and a half now, we've started off by saying that we cover indie and genre films. So Jill, just kind of give a very brief definition of what that is. Like, the reason we cover indie films is we're kind of try things that are off the beaten path. Yeah, we'll cover stuff like The Green Knight, Nope, we just did. But a lot of times we're covering things that, like The Feast, that are kind of just out there, out in left field, but eventually they'll end up on Hulu. So we watch movies so you don't have to, is what it basically amounts to. And we're hoping and we're counting on seeing a lot of future superstar actors, lots of great filmmakers and screenwriters. And that's why we cover indie films. But Blake, you might have an idea as to why we do genre.
So genre, that's actually kind of hard to define, really. I mean, to some degree, I mean, we're on a podcast, the horror podcasting network here on Morbidly Beautiful. And horror is obviously a genre of film. And so what we like to do on here is we are in the genre. So if we're covering horror, it'll be Grindhouse, you know, Kung Fu. These are all genre movies. And not that we're covering broad spectrum, big hits. You know, these things are typically smaller. That's not necessarily, but typically you find genre films, you know, a lot more indie stuff in genre. So, you know, and there's lots of history here in the genre, you know, whether you're talking about the history of zombie films or like I said, Kung Fu films, blaxploitation, these are all things that fall within the genre subcategory. And we find those things a lot of fun to talk about. So that's why we do that.
Yep, absolutely correct. So both these movies, before we get into them, they're both from the 70s.
They are. I think, Pat, that says a lot about us, I think.
I think it says something. So, spoiler warning right off the bat. Like, these are from decades ago. So, we are going to talk about every little detail that we feel like talking about when it comes to these movies. Secondly, and like you said, we both picked movies from the 70s, so it kind of says something about us. We also picked movies that... if you're a fan of animals, it wasn't planned. It just so happened that we picked some pretty graphic movies when it comes to animal cruelty. Nothing like Cannibal Holocaust, I hope.
Man, close.
Yeah, some pretty wild shit that we're covering. So yeah. The first movie we're covering is Tintorera, which is Spanish for tiger shark. This movie is, so it's kind of funny with, we were talking about Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg is responsible for one of the greatest exploitation movies of all time, Jaws.
Yeah.
Jaws just happened to break through to the mainstream. If that came out today, like, unfortunately, I don't think it would have, if he did the exact same movie today, just with, you know, updated special effects, it wouldn't have anywhere near the impact, unfortunately. Mm-mm. But so that is a Mexican film that came out in 77, which is a year or two after Jaws. But basically, it's about an, in the beginning, they say an American is coming.
Yeah.
Later, he clearly states he's a Mexican. Yeah. The actor is Mexican. It's about a dude who goes to an island paradise, is the only way I can describe this place. Right.
Or coastal, yeah. Coastal,
coastal paradise, yeah. And along the way, there's lots of partying, drinking, sexing, and yes, there is a killer shark.
Yes, there's also a killer shark involved
in this movie. So Tito Herrera is, I would say, and the reason that I picked it is because Steven Spielberg, I mean, we were kind of talking down on him, but he's responsible for doing so much for genre, indirectly, but I mean, he, because of him, we have stuff like Piranha, which gives us Joe Dante, which goes to The Howling and Gremlins, right. And right. I mean, he gave us, you know,
Duel, man.
Duel, and because of him, people did Grizzly and right. like that. So, I mean, right. he has a huge, huge impact on genre film. Tinto Herrera is its own take on Jaws. I would say that the best way to describe this movie is an orgy movie that happens to have a shark in it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I would say it's a orgy swinging, Mexican swinging, beach life living,
rumple having,
yeah, rumple having, sharks in the water fiasco, from start to finish. Let me ask you this though, because I didn't know, I expected exactly kind of what I got, honestly, from this movie, but I will say I found that it did a kind of an amazing job of keeping its story moving down the road. Like, it was kind of nonsensical.
It was.
But it stayed on task.
It did. And you know what else it did a really good job of is that you never knew who was going to die.
Totally. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about it later. Yeah, no, we'll talk about the end here in a little while. But yeah, you had no idea who was going to die. Everybody was fair game. Intermittently, you have... just like Free Love, man.
It's crazy. It's like it's the 70s. It's the late 70s, and it's, you know, notorious for sex and drugs. They have no drugs in this, so they double down on the sex.
They all, yeah, right, right.
And it's really funny because as open sexually as the 70s were, I don't know if, now I'm three ways in orgies were, you know, a dime a dozen, I'm sure. But an actual throuple, like a full functioning couple of three, where there's no drama whatsoever, I don't think this, that seems like it's a new term.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it must be, right? Well, and like let's enlighten everybody about how it starts. There's the first woman, right?
I thought she was gonna be a main player.
Me too. So she's in the movie for far too long, if for all things considered. But
yeah, considering what happens to her.
So she is with the dashing bearded Mexican guy who arrives by plane, seaplane. Yeah. And she gets fed up with his bullshit, I guess, one night, and then swims ashore to make the acquaintance of Manuel, I believe, or
Miguel.
Yeah. Miguel, also a handsome, dashing, very tan man with muscles.
Andreas Garcia,
famous.
Look him up. All his pictures are basically him completely nude, standing with a appropriately placed wine bottles, steering wheels, large objects. And he does it in this movie too.
Oh, numerous times. Oh, they got this guy naked as much as possible. It was kind of amazing. And so she comes ashore to, like I said, make his acquaintance. These guys kind of have, they fight basically. And, but that causes no real ill will as
the exact opposite.
The exact opposite. So we do have our first kill of the movie, which is that isn't animal related. She's just going out for a morning swim. I don't think she's going in anywhere particular. And
no, just skinny dipping.
She gets decimated in a pretty graphic shark scene by the tiger shark. Let's real quick talk about the animal murder.
Well, first of all, the shark itself is, it sounded like he was like a creepy pervert, which is how the movie opens. So you're like, oh, wow, am I watching that One Missed Call movie?
Yeah, no, you're right. The shark does this. It's such a horrible sound.
He's like, yeah, he's very much out of the 80s. Like the whole, they have 900 numbers for that.
Yeah, no, totally. He's a perv. He's a total perv. Obviously, he's hanging around this beach. He just wants to feast on nude people. So.
Which he does. I'd say there's not many kills in this, but no. I'd say the vast majority of them are nude women.
I'd say at least two. Yeah, at least a half or more are nude women. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Sure. Yeah. And intermittently, there's lots of beautiful shots of underwater spear fishing.
I think that was actual footage.
I think it was. No, it is for a fact. 100% fact. It's one of like the little tidbits about this movie if you read about it. And they don't know how many. It's like that one thing we had for that one movie. Well, we don't know how many rats were killed during the filming of this, like
thousands. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like this is like, yeah, like I think a lot of stingrays.
I'm sure of it. And you know, the ones that made me worry were the shark scenes.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering, like, are they killing real sharks here?
At first I was certain that they weren't. By the end of the movie, I was certain that they were.
At first I was, so I mean, the very first shark encounter you have is I don't know if they ever give the name of the I don't know, the guy with like the kind of dyed blonde hair.
Oh yeah, like their cabin boy.
The cabin boy, like he pulls the shark up and he's like, I don't know if he's dead, but I'm gonna hit him anyway.
Yeah,
I love it. He just starts beating the hell out of this shark. So I was kind of opposite of you. At first I was like, you know what, these are like real sharks, I think this is pretty crazy. But then towards the end I was like, you know, I know the footage is real, but I think the sharks might not be, because like when Miguel is like, I mean, he's just literally chomped in half. Like there is a impressive looking shark swimming away with Miguel's head in his mouth. So
that was great. Yeah. Love that. And his guts were super real. Whatever guts those were real guts.
Yeah. So, and Andreas Garcia, he did do movies afterwards. So I know
it wasn't his guts. No, yeah, his guts. No, it was probably a sheep or something that they clubbed in the head on the beach.
Off screen. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the cabrito from lunch.
And this movie, it's so, Hugo Stiglitz, I think is how you pronounce the name. He is so funny in this movie, and forgetting like dubbing or whatever, like he just has these dead eyes. Oh. And sometimes the camera will just focus on him and he'll have this creepy smile on his face and he's just like staring into somebody's soul.
Dude, like there are so many scenes that I was like, is he about to lose it? And then he like and then he starts to smile and he's like taking off his clothes. It's like, all right, Steven's game, I guess. He just had to think about it. It's all good.
That his character is so, because you're right, him and Miguel, like the initial confrontation, it ends in a fist, well, Steven knocking him out basically. Also funny thing about this movie is it's in English for the majority, some of it's in Spanish, but not all of it is subtitled.
Right.
And that exchange isn't subtitled, but it's actually really hilarious because Steven comes up to Miguel and Miguel's like, hey, come on, why don't you sit down here with me? And then they're talking or whatever, and they're going back and forth, and I can only pick up bits and pieces of it. My Spanish isn't the best, but there comes a point where Steven, when he's ignoring Miguel and he's only talking to the woman, and then Miguel tells him, you know what, I rescind my invitation, fuck off. And that's when Steven knocks him out, yeah, or punches him.
No, so the dialogue in this movie was actually pretty funny. There was the cabin boy had some lines in it. He also, by far the party that got broken up the earliest was his party on top.
He was just having it.
Yeah, he just invites all his naked friends over to party, dude. It was great.
Not enough of that guy. I really liked him.
I did too. Not that our leads weren't great, but like you said, this movie turns from like, well, I had no idea. I guess there's a shark. It kills the one girl. You're like, okay, well, they're gonna start hunting sharks apparently at some point in time. No, not for a good long time. What you are now introduced to, and I don't even remember how they meet her. There's a British chick who shows up.
Yeah, she is just hanging out at a bar.
Yeah,
and they are, and they happen to be there, and then they're like, "I bet you can. I can sleep with her first. No, I bet I will.
That's what.
So it was. They both go and talk to her, take her to Steven's yacht. And both proceed
they
to sleep
with her. Yeah. And then they basically wake up and are like, we're in a relationship now, everybody. The rule, number one rule is no falling in love.
Yeah.
Rule number two, anything goes, baby.
Yeah. It's two for one and one for two. Just amazing. When they wake up the next morning, there's this awesome scene of Steven in the kitchen. Just wearing an apron, ass right. naked.
Ass naked, yeah.
Asking them what kind of eggs they want.
Yeah. And by the way, this is the only woman, single woman, that they approach. Otherwise, these guys always approach women in pairs.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Otherwise, it's two, it's always two for one.
But, you know, it is with them. Like Miguel, I love how he's very open about the fact that he is a gigolo. He's just out to... And he's basically using those skills on Steven.
Yeah. So he's awesome. Like, hey, you know, sometimes I pay, sometimes they pay.
Yeah, you know, but you know.
We all sort out the checks in the morning.
And they have a bet at one point where he's like, yeah, if I lose the bet, you have to pay for everything. Like you always do.
Yeah. They're always like ribbing each other and shit. Yeah, they love it.
Just some cool shit. A great cameo towards the end for Three's Company's fan. Terry. So this is the.
Oh, yeah.
Terry is, in fact, one of the women who.
That's right. Yeah. Well, gotta have topless babes. She better be one of them.
Exactly. And if you can't find Tinto Data, because it is on YouTube, it's not on any number. You can always watch Mallrats to see her topless.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, Tintolera is from 1977, not on your traditional streaming platforms, but you can find it on YouTube without any ads, so definitely check it out.
Yeah, you gotta see it.
So for our second movie, I am going to throw it to Blake. What do you have for us, and why did you do it?
Oh, that's a great question that I may not have the best answer for. I don't know, so... When you see a movie titled Rancho Deluxe, it rings the ear just the kind of the right way. And we wanted, like Pat said earlier, we're trying to pick movies that kind of defined what this show is all about. And I hadn't seen this before, but the description is two drifters of widely varying backgrounds rustle cattle and try to avoid being caught in contemporary Montana. Now I'm going to read the poster. And this is going to explain why I picked it. Oh, give me a home with a low interest loan, a cowgirl and two pickup trucks, a color TV. All the beer should be free. And that man is Rancho Deluxe.
Wonderful.
That defines why I picked this. Look, we like doing weird shit. This is obviously a 70s, like kind of like Western exploitation, kind of like sexy vibes too, but not over the top. It just sounded like a lot of fun. It also happens to star Jeff Bridges, Sam Waterston, and my personal favorite, Harry Dean Stanton. And so why wouldn't we pick this? Why wouldn't we pick this? And I think as we will go on, I think it was a solid pick.
I think that another great answer would have been, we have never covered a movie that so proudly takes place in Montana.
Is there another? I just
we heard about Billings and I think some other cities there, and they mentioned the governor. I mean, they were very proud to be in Montana. But yeah, this movie, I think, very much is a great like screenshot of what our show is about.
Yeah.
This came out in the early 70s, I think. I think it's interesting 75. Because 75. So it's in that weird area where so Westerns have already had their time. They're kind of on the decline. But the next wave of, like, I don't think the trucker craze has hit yet.
Right.
So it's kind of in this middle ground where it's a modern Western, but it has like very 1975 like sensibilities to it. Like you wouldn't mistake it for like Rio Bravo or anything like that.
By no means. No, the aesthetic of the whole thing, like the way they dress is, I mean, you could probably put them in like an 80s movie in a Western setting and it would have been the same. Right. You know, and what you, this movie's so weird. I don't even know how you come up with this idea, really. The story is Jack and Cliff, was it Cecil? Jack and Cecil.
Cecil, yeah, Cecil.
Played by Sam Waterston and Jeff Bridges. They're like two just buddies.
Drifters.
Drifters.
Well, I guess they're not drifters.
Jack comes from like a super well-to-do family, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask about that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll get, there's also a scene in that house that is totally confounding. And Cecil is, as they bring up numerous times, he's a half Native American man. And these guys are kind of just out to, you know, do their thing.
Live their lives.
They want that Rancho Deluxe life. But yeah, so there's a scene early on with Jeff Bridges and what you presume is his ex-girlfriend, I guess, or ex-fiance maybe. His parents have set this up, so I guess to convince Jack to get back to his like normal ways.
Yeah, to leave the
wrestling life.
Yeah, the wild west of Montana, and come back to wherever he flew to.
Wherever he was, and his ex girlfriend comes in, who seems very nice.
Yeah,
and basically just said she loves him and would like to him to be come back so she could spend more time, and he goes atomic.
Right, this is, it's one of the weird things about the movie, and I don't mean it in a bad way. It's right. So when I think of the 70s, I think of these big performances like Marlon Brando and Apocalypse Now type of thing, and in this movie it's very grounded and understated. Like there's, in the beginning especially, there's lots of scenes of it's Jack, right? Jack and Cecil, they're just in the truck and they're just throwing questions back and forth to each other, like, and that's all
driving around. Yeah, they're just buddies driving around.
They're just bullshitting, and then every once in a while, and that scene is the most best example of it. You'll get this huge explosion, and I mean, he goes nuts. He's throwing shit, breaking dishes, like it's crazy.
He throws the centerpiece into their like armoire full of dishes.
Fine china.
Like,
yeah. It's the craziest thing. I'm glad that you brought up the two leads, because one of the reasons we cover genre movies also is that everyone talks about, you know, Jennifer Aniston coming out in Leprechaun, and then Kevin Bacon in Friday the 13th, and even now Anya Taylor-Joy in The Witch. Like, these types of movies are where you will find like the stars of tomorrow type of thing. And whoever was watching this movie back then, whatever agents and Hollywood people are watching this, they got to see some outstanding performances from these two.
Yeah. I mean, I like Sam Waterston a lot. And he's actually an actor that I've always felt like, man, I wish I would have seen him in more stuff. And to see him this young and in this kind of role is such a unique thing. And Jeff Bridges is kind of Jeff Bridges. I mean, he's kind of
like
doing
the dude, but like the alpha version of him.
Yeah, yeah, like the Chad dude. If the dude was a Chad.
Yeah.
But it's like just like you said, super great. And then this is also just Slim Pickens is in this, and
a great role.
Oh, a super great role. Clifton James. Is an old-timey Western actor who kind of plays like the ranch owner or whatever. And there's a lot at play here. I will say this, the first like third of the movie kind of just jumps from scene to scene to scene to scene to scene to scene.
Yeah,
there's like no like through line really at all, until you kind of get halfway through, and then there's kind of like, okay, well, you kind of see where like there's this kind of scam being put together, and now we have this what do they call him? He's got a great title for what he is. Slim Pickens' character, he's like a
he's the something inspector. Cattle inspector.
Yeah, it's something to do with basically wrestling and cattle and infringement.
He's a great detective of the range.
He's a Western detective. That's when the movie actually kind of starts to come together a little bit. It was kind of meandering.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and then I like that as the movie kind of goes on, that it becomes more solidified, which is nice.
It in the beginning, it kind of has a bunch of tones going to it. It's kind of
right.
This character study, it's kind of a wacky comedy, and then sometimes you're like, I don't know what the hell is going on here. But yeah, once it gets down to like there's gonna be a cattle heist.
Yeah,
it becomes like really, really straightforward and fun, like a lot more fun, yeah. I thought at that point. Okay. Harry Dean Stanton, too, you brought him up. I think he was the best character the best performance. Like he was Kurt, right?
Kurt, not Bert.
Not Bert, he was Kurt. I thought he was such a great character. I absolutely loved him.
Yeah, you actually, he becomes, when you first see him, he's actually kind of scary. Yeah. Both those guys are kind of intimidating, and as it goes on, like you said, his character development is tremendous. You mm-hmm. you see emotion and thoughtfulness and caring and scheming
and understanding.
Yeah, you see it all, and totally took me by surprise. I did not expect that from that character. Obviously, he's awesome, but I didn't expect it from that character, to be honest with you.
No, I didn't either. Like I thought that. He would like kind of, well, in the end, he does get his like just desserts, I guess. Yeah. But I thought he really loved me. I thought that he would, you know, try to capture the wrestlers and they would get one over on him. But it turns out he was actually working with them. So another thing, and I'm kind of going to backtrack here. Sure. The scene where Jeff Daniels goes back to Jeff Daniels or Jeff Bridges?
Jeff Bridges.
I always do that. Yeah. Jeff Bridges goes back to his family home. I think that's really interesting because it shows how things have changed, because in 1975, you have that scene. He's a rich boy who's gone out to the ranch and he goes back home and it's like he's an independent spirit. He's free thinking. He's rebellious and it's cool. You do that scene today and it's like, oh, look at this poser. He's not a real cowboy. He comes from a rich family. He's privileged. I thought that it was really cool to see that, because as I was watching, I was like, oh, wow, he's rich. And then I was like, oh, man, this dude, he plays by the beat of his own drum. He's cool. Like, if I were to see that in something from 2022, I'd be like, yeah, look at this fucking fake cowboy.
Yeah, no, totally.
Like,
totally.
It's really well.
It is. And like, even like, let's say if it was 5 years sooner, 1968, 69, Vietnam's going on and stuff, like that character is a completely portrayed completely differently probably. So yeah, I mean, that it's a tremendous snapshot of like post-Vietnam all the way leading up until like basically the 90s, when, you know, dudes could fuck off and go to Montana and wrestle cattle. Totally acceptable, man.
Just such a guy. And then I mean, I think it would be wrong of us to not talk about the soundtrack. Just some amazing music in this.
Yeah, I mean, highlighted by one Jimmy Buffett, who makes a full-on appearance playing in the bar.
An amazing song, also just very amazing
toe-tapping. Oh, toe-tapping. It's got great lyrics. He's rocking an incredible mustache for this movie. Actually, the director of the film is playing mandolin in the band.
Awesome.
But fun fact. But yeah, no, the soundtrack's great. It's kind of like this, like, dumbass 70s kind of disco country.
Yeah, just straight. And there were so many lines that I wanted to put into the opening for this. Like, there's what, wash my pickup truck and I just got paid. Now I'm going to go out and it's time to get laid. just amazing stuff. Like, people make fun of country music and stuff, but this is like you said, a disco country hybrid, but lyrically powerful stuff.
I want to see a rock opera basically based on Livingston, Montana.
A Livingston Saturday night.
Yeah, Livingston Saturday night. Yes.
So Rancho Deluxe, definitely check this one out. Much easier to find. Prime Video, it is there if you're a subscriber. Alienoid from South Korea. It is a time traveling epic that involves aliens, robots, magicians, monks, and magical cats. What more can you ask for? The Blu-ray is going out to Blue Rain 79. Their name is Rainer. So if you're listening, thank you for entering our podcast. I will be reaching out to you to get your information.
Congratulations.
So, every weekend, you could catch us here. We're a part of the Morbidly Beautiful Podcast Network. where one of, like Blake said, there's a bunch of horror theme podcasts on there, plus they have us. We also have an open review policy. Let us know what you want us to see. We have 200 episodes of all kinds of stuff. You let us know what you want us to see. We'll watch it.
We'll watch it. Let us know. Talk to us on the old social medias. You can follow the show on Twitter and Instagram. It's Adventures in Movies. You can find Nathaniel. I call him Patrick. I did it multiple times on the show. On Instagram, at Adventures in Nathan. You can find myself, Blake, on Twitter, at Four Eyed Horror. Regina, she'll be back next week. She's on Instagram, at Danger Chavez. And next week, well, I don't know if how I should tease this. Number turn? let's see what that means.
You can find out what that's all about on Apple Podcasts. You can go to Spotify. Amazon Music also has podcasts now. You can also go to Morbidly Beautiful and check us out wherever you listen to us. Make sure to leave a rating or just tell a friend to listen. And that's our cue. We will talk to you next week.
On to 200 more.